The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
On News Talk.
We're going to be talking about news fatigue now, which apparently it's a real thing. Brendan Kelly is a professor of psychiatry at Trinity College Dublin. Brendan, is it? What is it if it is?
Yes, it's a real thing. News fatigue happens when we consume a lot of news. Nowadays, it's often online and we begin to tire of it. And what happens is it loses its impact or it becomes a sort of a very negative drone in the background. And either we stop engaging with it properly or some people stop engaging at all and because of this cut themselves off from the world and decide to live in their own bubble without any without being informed about what's happening at all. So it's the state of mind just before people do that.
And what are we trying to avoid then from a societal point of view is, well, I assume we're trying to avoid that people completely switch off, but we don't want people to be inundated to the point that they feel they need to switch off. So it's what? The kind of Goldilocks zone, the just right amount of news.
The just right amount of news, the just right kind of news as well. We have a responsibility to stay informed about the world, to bear witness to the suffering of other people, to know about terrible things that are happening. But also we have a responsibility to ourselves to remain well so that we can be engaged with the news. So it is about setting boundaries, setting parameters and maybe knowing when to step back and knowing when to lean in and remembering often the news is a very distorted version of the world, reporting the worst, the most dramatic, the atypical, rather than the typical and the moderate, which makes up most of human life.
And so the volume of it that we're being bombarded with, that's a problem. The nature of it as well, has that changed? I mean, you know, a lot of those news organisations, and listen, we're a commercial entity as well, I should acknowledge that, but, you know, they're competing for eyeballs and clicks and what have you, so the more sensational, the better.
Yeah, I mean, the nature of news delivery has changed and therefore the nature of consumption has changed. And that role that used to be occupied by the rather paternalistic editor who decided how much of what we saw in the evening news, how many minutes or how many column inches in newspapers were devoted to things, that role is largely gone or we're doing it ourselves and we're not doing it very well. We tend to follow excitement, whether it's positive or negative, and it's mainly negative, so we keep on clicking down these rabbit holes. So I think we have an editorial role to play in our own lives now that we used not have, maybe 20 years ago, I'm guessing.
Yeah, and I'm actually just looking up here at the screen at Jimmy Kimmel, who's lost his job in the States, it looks like, because of what he said after Charlie Kirk was shot. And of course, how many of us, after Charlie Kirk was shot, saw the actual images of Charlie Kirk being shot online? You know, so it's not just those news outlets, it's news platforms, if we'll call it that, which is what X describes itself as, a news platform, as well as a social media site, see these videos shared. How, from a technological point of view, then, Elaine, sorry, I should have introduced you, I didn't, Elaine Burke from the For Tech's Sake podcast is with us as well in studio. How, from a technological point of view, can you deal with news fatigue or combat it?
Curate your feeds. Genuinely, like if at all possible, and it's becoming harder to do this, but follow who you want to follow. You know, we're familiar now with platforms kind of designing themselves around serving up content that you never actually chose to see to begin with. And it's not just advertising, it's other accounts that are seen as influential or important for whatever reason or popular. And the more you're seeing of that, the more likely you're you know, broadening what you should see. And normally I do like to tell people to broaden what they're going to see. But if you are feeling fatigued by what you're seeing, start deleting people who are constantly posting things that you find depressing. Genuinely, you do have to kind of like safeguard yourself in that way. And I'm really glad you brought up this whole idea of platforms as well and their influence on news and how they do see themselves as news platforms. They're not regulated like news platforms. Editorial decision making in newsrooms will involve having a think of how to present content that's shocking and disturbing, and usually will provide primers. And even when they share this content on social media, they won't have it that the very first seconds of a video will show you the most horrifying aspects of it. It will have a point of where you can kind of choose to scroll on or move away. It will give you a warning and a few seconds to decide. And following more kind of news organizations that take that kind of editorial decision making could be helpful as well. But as you mentioned, the news organizations are shaping themselves into this social media age. And actually, often editorial decision making is as much driven by social media activity as it is by what would have been the more traditional signals of editorial decision making. So say even for the radio team that you have here, you may have previously used the engagement that you got from listeners texting and calling and stuff like that on a topic to see like, oh, that's obviously a hot topic. That's something that our listeners are interested in. That's how we will engage with it. But now if you're taking signals from social media, and I have to say, there's like a huge amount of bot activity online, like a huge amount of it. You are probably taking signals from the wrong places. And it is things that are on the fringes, that are in the extremes, that are going viral because they are in those extremes and things like that. And that's actually quite damaging.
I wonder, I'd say maybe this is a triumph of hope over expectation or experience, but I wonder whether there was actually some perversely value in Elon Musk buying Twitter, because I think that actually happens. And I just, this is anecdote masquerading as evidence. I see it happening slightly less. I think because he bought it, there was kind of suddenly there was more attention paid on maybe how messages were being pushed in a certain direction. And certainly the conversations in production meetings in this building, and I can only speak of this building, you hear a lot less of, oh, such and such is happening on Twitter, or people are saying this on Twitter, or this is trending on Twitter, therefore we should cover it in such a way. That's fallen by the wayside.
Right. I saw that as well, and you'd see this because I'm in the same boat. I'm from the media, and we all got caught in that bubble. I was one of them. I was one of these people who thought if it was on Twitter and it was trending, it was newsworthy.
Yeah, everyone was talking about it. This was evidence. Everyone was talking about it.
Everyone on Twitter was talking about it, or everyone on Irish Twitter was talking about it, or something like that. And there was some validity to that, but we all did get caught in a bubble there. I definitely think that. And there has been a struggle to move away from that, I think, as well, because it was an easy access point to signals. Because editorial decision making is hard on a day-to-day basis. If there isn't one big story happening, you have to make choices on a bunch of mostly relevant stories, and you have to make the decision of what five of these can we possibly cover. And it's good to have things that can signal that. But I think the signals that are coming from social media aren't as healthy or valid as they used to be.
Brendan, if you're being bombarded then with all of this information, but you don't withdraw from it, you allow it to keep washing over you, what happens, say, to your levels of compassion?
Yeah, so your empathy starts to get eroded, and your responsiveness moment to moment gets blunted as well. And you start, you know, everything merges into this one form of news, this one tone, and news starts to lose its meaning. You start to feel distanced. And we know this already. Technology distances us from the humanity of what we're seeing very often. There can be that initial shock, but then there's a distancing as well. So it's really very mentally unhealthy. And certainly if you're looking at disturbing news, or if you follow the shocking clips all the time, that does lead to heightened arousal, hypervigilance, and living in a sort of a hyped up state, which is very unhealthy for our bodies.
And to what extent are, you know, news organizations, social media platforms, whoever it is that we're talking about, to what extent are they taking advantage of or exploiting just quirks of human psychology as well? You know, that there's a bit of us that slows down to look at the car crash on the other side of the road.
There is. Look, humans are hungry for emotion, stimulus and stimulation, and we'll follow that no matter what it is, be it positive or negative. And it is much easier for news outlets and platforms to generate negative stories than it is positive ones that will engage us. So, I mean, they are tapping into a human propensity to follow the drama, for sure. However, we are responsible for our own behaviour as well, and each individual consumer of the news is responsible for how they do that and for being aware of what's going on and being aware of our biases. One of the best ways to combat this, of course, is to step away from the technology for defined periods of time every day, or better yet, to step towards it only at defined periods of time. So tuning into the news maybe twice or three times a day and trying to avoid the constant drip, 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 which erodes at our well-being through the day.
Okay, between 4 and 7 o'clock weekdays, obviously people should be, you know, absolutely consuming current affairs content on the radio. How important then is it, Elaine, to actually use the technology then to aid us in this, not to see it as the enemy? I'm talking about maybe, you know, notification settings and all of that.
Oh, well,
you know, we're all guilty of it. Everybody suddenly looks at their starts scrambling for phones and we realise that we're all subscribed to the same news outlet. We've all just got a notification.
Because a fairly recent feature was this idea of push notifications from various news services and apps. And it's like, do you know what, lads? You're not going to miss it. If big news happens, you're going to hear about it. And just because you didn't hear about it first doesn't mean it's not going to come around to you. Like, we all have like this intensity about us these days of like wanting to know everything all at once. And sometimes I don't think that is helpful in a news environment. Like, even with things that have been happened recently with like an active investigation going into who shot Charlie Kirk, like, I don't think it was necessarily a good idea for the entire world and some self-declared online sleuths to have been following that story with the intensity that they were and with the information that they were getting to piece together various conspiracy theories. Like, none of that was helpful in that scenario at all. And I'm always talking on various shows about how, yes, you should turn off all your notifications, all of them. Only apps that you really need notification for are your phone, which won't ring that much. It might be a scam caller these days, most likely. Because like in a case of emergency, you're probably going to get a call. But other notifications, you most likely don't need them. Now, yeah. I have all my notifications turned off. I still tap into my apps more often than
do
I
do. Do you bring your
like
phone
should.
Into the bedroom?
I try not to, but absolutely, I do. Like, I preach that you shouldn't, but I do it myself. Like, I know I shouldn't. But because I know I don't have the best, most restful night's sleep. But when I do, I often have it in the dark mode, the bedtime mode. And it reminds me that, no, you're only really supposed to be opening like a podcast to listen to sleep at this time of night. So there's other
you
ways.
Don't always do it, like, though.
Yeah. But honestly, putting your phone away, when you sit down at night to watch television, when you're watching the Traitors finale and stuff like that, put your phone somewhere on the other side of the room and you won't get, even if it starts pinging, you won't get up to get it because we're, you know, in a sense of comfort there and we don't want to be disturbed.
How much does it affect us, Brendan, if it's the last thing we do as well at night and the first thing we do in the morning?
Yeah, that affects us a lot. I mean, phones don't belong in bedrooms and we should try and have a screen-free time prior to bed and not log in immediately in the morning. That shouldn't be the first thing. The phone should be away from you. It's astonishing what you describe. The longer the physical distance between you and your phone, the less likely you are to reach for it, even if it's the other side of the room. So we should exploit that pure laziness. That
the fridge doesn't work that way, though, for some reason. I always find the motivation motivation to get there. Yeah.
Well, some people put the phone in the fridge, although I suspect in your case that really wouldn't work out.
No,
at all.
It wouldn't. Double reward. That's what I'd see when I get there. Anyway, Brendan, thanks for coming into us, Elaine, too. Brendan Kelly, Professor of Psychiatry at Trinity College Dublin, Elaine Burke from the For Tech's Sake podcast.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.